Are you also tired of one-size-fits-all weight loss plans? Meet Noom, the personalized solution that meets you where you are. Noom is able to understand your unique needs, from dietary restrictions to medical concerns. Unlike restrictive programs, Noom embraces your lifestyle and choices. Discover a sustainable approach to weight loss, tailored just for you. Honestly, Noom felt like it was made for me. It's not just about what I eat. It's about understanding why. With Noom, I've learned so much about myself and built healthier habits that stick. It's all about progress, not perfection. Say goodbye to restrictive diets and experience the Noom app for yourself with personalized lessons and expert coaching. Noom's psychology and biology-based approach has helped over 5.2 million people achieve their goals. Stay focused on what's important to you with Noom's psychology and biology-based approach. Sign up for your trial today at Noom.com. That's Noom.com. And check out Noom's first ever cookbook, The Noom Kitchen, for 100 healthy and delicious recipes to promote better living. Available to buy now wherever books are sold.
This is episode 25 of The Living Reminders with Mary and Blake. From Providence, Rhode Island, welcome to The Living Reminders. It's a podcast dedicated to the leftovers on HBO. We're still here and so are you. So let's chat with Amy Brenneman. Suddenly I'm here. It's the darkness of the dawn. And your friends are gone. And your friends won't come. So show me where you fit. Hello, everyone. I'm your host, Mary Larson.
My name's Blake, and I love the idea of grabbing and stealing laptops from little kids.
Me too.
I think it's a great idea.
Especially if it's yours. That poor kid, though, he's going to have nightmares for the rest of his life about some blonde, dirty blonde lady coming on in with curly hair. Curly hair flying like mad, stealing stuff.
On fire. just grab and take. Grab
crazy,
and take.
Crazy town.
Imagine that. Imagine some lady just coming in your room. You don't even know who she is.
And
she's just taking your stuff.
I'm not kidding. That kid's going to be in therapy. I got broken into once. And I'm like freaked out every single time I hear a creak in the floor. The kid's going to have serious issues.
Well, my love, what are we doing here today?
We are having a third episode of this recorded week because, yeah. You know, the Living Reminders, we just can't get enough of the leftovers. It's like we're just so excited that the show's back, that we're on crack, and we're like, let's talk about it all the time. And so in addition to our first episode and then our second episode of listener feedback, we actually had an awesome interview. We
That's
got
right.
to interview Amy Brenneman,
That's
who
correct.
Plays Lori, the laptop girl that we've known to love. Really, really excited to be able to share this with you guys. It's just such an honor to be able to interview these stars and to share these conversations and get feedback from you guys and all the questions. So thank you all for your excitement. I don't even feel like talking that much more. I just want to get into this interview.
Let's do it.
Joining us today is Amy Brenneman, a multi-time Emmy Award nominated actress, writer, and producer who starred in NYPD Blue, Judging Amy, and Private Practice. She's also starred in various feature films, including Heat, Fear, and Daylight. But we all know her as the silent, troubled, and deeply conflicted Lori Garvey on her favorite television show right now on HBO, The Leftovers. Amy, thank you so much for joining us here on The Living Reminders today.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
What drew you to this role and to this show? It seems a bit of a departure, no pun intended, and yet pun intended, from the series leads that you've had in the past, medical and cop, etc.
What drew me to the role was Tom Perata and Damon Lindelof. You know, I think you do different jobs for different reasons, just like everybody. When I am in producing mode, you know, like I was in Judging Amy, I have sort of a different relationship to the show, obviously. But, I mean, similarly to Private Practice, actually, in that case, I really was interested in Shonda Rhimes. And in this case, it was Damon. So less of the role. I mean, I liked, I mean, it was really, there was so little on the page, especially for Lori in the first season, for all of us really, but I didn't even have lines. So you really are trusting and staying engaged with the creator. I also, you know, Damon won me over when he said, here are the three reasons why you shouldn't take this job. And I said, okay. And he said, it shoots in New York, and I live in Los Angeles with my kids. He said, you don't wear any makeup, and you have no lines. And I said, okay, sign me up. That sounds really good.
Did you read the book before you were cast in the role? And if you did, or if you read it since, well, why you were cast, were there any tips or ideas you took from the book iteration of Lori? You know, like, for example, in the show, Lori seems a little bit more strict and a little bit more silent than her book role.
Well, I didn't read it before I got the role, but, and then as soon as I was cast, actually, I remember the table read, you know, they said, okay, anybody that hasn't read the book, don't read the book. And Tom said that as well, because like, so going to be so different and don't, you know, get attached to the book. I, of course, immediately went out and read the book, partly because, you know, the book, as you know, I mean, it's about a third, a half to a third really of Lori's, inner monologue. So when you have a character that has no lines of dialogue, then I have to get the beat on what she's thinking. I mean, that said, the tone of our show and therefore the characters are quite different from the book. And Lori was, you know, I think kind of a homemaker, you know, I think she, all of Tom's, choices were a little bit lighter and a little bit more sarcastic or, ironic. And he has that wonderful, tone, you know, so we sort of dug in with Lori and made her a little bit more complicated, a little stronger, a little darker.
And did you like that change? Do you think it was good for the character itself?
Yeah, I mean, the book, you know, for Lori, it's like the book, there wouldn't be much to play. I mean, really, it was her responses. And so I think in general, I mean, the miracle of the show is like, how do you take this amazing premise, you know, and Tom's kind of amazing creative, you know, creation of this worldview, but give it some narrative drive, not only for one episode, but for, in this case, 20. So I think in general, it became more muscular, and it, and I think HBO actually wanted it to sort of go deep and dark, especially that first season, and not have, you know, Tom's stuff like Election and Little Children and even Leftovers has, you know, it has this wonderful kind of sardonic, has a humor to it that, and we have humor in ours, but I would say it's a different quality for sure.
So preparing for your role, did you try to go for long stretches without speaking while you were researching it? Was it harder or easier than one might imagine?
I did not care that way now. Although the one way I did, I, you know, I'm a very lazy actress. I just sort of kind of, it really comes alive for me when the camera's on me, or, you know, not, you know, just sort of like that's when it becomes real. Although, because we shot in New York and I was on, I can't even count that first season, how many planes I was on. I said to my husband, I was like, oh my God, I play a woman who's abandoned her children. And once a week I get on a plane and I abandon my children. So I think what did feed quite nicely into the state of mind that for the first season especially is, you know, I was like constantly in these location vans at 3 a.m. in frigid weather. I mean, I'm sure you've heard about that first season, by myself. I mean, I was constantly by myself. So I almost didn't really have to work at it. And then what's interesting is, you know, it's funny how the quality of the piece and the quality of the character always sort of infiltrates the vibe on the set. So just playing Lori, you know, cause I'm a very chatty person, but when I played Lori, I just thought I didn't chat as much, you know, in between takes and all that kind of bonhomie, you know, I just sort of stayed to myself quite a bit.
You know, you talked about being a lazy actor there. I just want to follow up on that. What's it like to just all of a sudden turn that silence on, you know, oddly enough, for the camera, like going from a producerial role, like in previous roles that you've had, to all of a sudden just being an actress and then not talking. Describe that feeling of just all of a sudden turning it on.
Well, the not producing piece is a joy. Producing's really hard, and I love it, and I will, you know, I'm doing it now on this NBC show, and it's part of what I do. But it's also really fun not to do it, and you know, Leftovers is like a production, you know, Herculean effort. So, you know, there'd be so many. I mean, every day it was like a mountain. You know, it's like, oh, we're losing the light and this and that. And, you know, I was like, oh, I'm not producing. I'm so happy. So that was fine. You know, I think for me the big leap. I think I was pretty uncomfortable. Although I'm sort of used to being filmed even before I figured things out. So the first couple episodes of last season, I was, you know, was as you do, you know, sort of exploring on camera. But for me, the big leap was recognizing how, you know, I've done a lot of theater. I come from theater, as most of us do, and I was a modern dancer, and we was, you know, the kind of theater I was into was very abstract. And when I thought of it that way, I realized, like, oh my God, I've actually played a lot of roles where I don't speak. You know, it's just more expected on stage where you have more abstraction, you know, than in film and television, which is usually pretty narrative. So once I sort of let myself go into that, and it wasn't like, okay, this is, if you have no lines, it's like, no, this is a whole other, you know, it's sort of like watercolors and sculpture. I mean, it's just a whole other medium.
Yeah, we actually had the pleasure of speaking with Ann Dowd over the break.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, she's a Massachusetts girl, and I'm so proud of that. You know, she talked about finding herself and making people almost uncomfortable when she didn't talk and interacting with those around her. Is there anything like that she said for you that she learned stuff from other people when she was not speaking for in your terms?
Well, I think you know, you watch a lot more, you observe a whole lot more, you know. It's funny, I talk about this with my kids a lot because they're 14 and 10. Social pressure and social anxiety is kind of a real thing, you know, and so, and I'm a very social person, so it's not like I'm anxious, but even the natural, you know, what we're doing right now, conversational pragmatics, right? There's a certain exercise to that. There's a certain energy, there's a certain focus, like you say something, I say something, you know. When you step away from that and you kind of watch it like it was a play, you learn a lot. You know, I never really connected as much to the aspect of the GR that was sort of menacing or bullying. I really liked the aspect that was like this a witness, you know, kind of a neutral energy. You know, that was, and that's, I think, what I really enjoyed about last year.
Speaking about Ann Dowd, when we talked with her, she talked about how the relationship between Patty and Laurie was really special. So can you comment on their relationship, and what about Patty made sense for Laurie?
Well, I'm so glad she said that. I mean, we love each other. We've loved each other forever. Well, I mean, I think it's all in the writing. I mean, you have this, you know, when you see it all in the flashback, it's like, here's this woman who's like Chicken Little, and the sky is falling, and, you know, you kind of assume that's false, and you sort of dismiss that person as a crazy person. And then when they are right, they are emboldened in a pretty wild way, you know? So I think it went from sort of, you know, she was my student, if you will, as my client, as my patient, to she knew something, you know? So in this time when everybody's sort of looking for guidance, looking for solidity, Patty was the person that seemed to know what was going on. I think that because of their former relationship, I was never the good acolyte that she would have liked me to be. And that was sort of what I said to Damon, you know, like I said, listen, there's all these descriptions of Laurie as sort of like stoic and enigmatic and menacing. And I said, you know, I can do all that. And I like all that, but you know, you cast somebody who has a really mobile face. Like I have a thought and it shows up on my face. So I think what this is going to be is Laurie trying to be a good GR, you know, trying to be stoic and menacing, but not doing a very good job, which is really what the story of the first season was.
Why do you think she struggles so much with being a good GR, as you put it?
Well, I mean, a million reasons. I mean, she has kids. I don't think Patty had kids. You know, she's tied. She's tied to the earth, you know, in a way that is very hard to untangle. I also think, you know, Damon once said, you know, because the whole thing, what do they believe? What do they believe? You know, it's just like in this last episode that I was in. What do they believe? And he once said a really good, I thought it was very wise. He said, listen, I think it's a little bit like the Occupy movement, where there's no central belief, right? But they are united in what they don't want to do. And they don't want to participate in, you know, living life, you know, like, let's go back to the way things were, right? They are agreed that that's not what they want to do. However, I think as, you know, last season, as the GR and Patty at the helm became more and more violent and provocative, I don't think Lori signed up for that. You know, I think it was more like, you know, and this isn't just to make my character more likable, but it's like, I think Lori thought, okay, we're going to be, you know, like Quaker witnesses, you know, we're going to, you know, be a living reminder, but we're not actually going to blow shit up. So I think that's like the MLK Malcolm X moment, you know, and obviously the last episode when I put my daughter in harm's way, I mean, something just really broke inside of me.
So when you, speaking of this, of the last episode that you were just in, Off Ramp, what was your first reaction to Lori's story when you read the script? I mean, you went from putting your daughter, Jill, in the GR and having it almost burn in that house. Wow, I kind of feel like the book publisher right now. I feel terrible. Please don't attack me. spoiler alert.
Don't jump out of the phone.
I know. No, what was that? What was that like reading that script and finally finding out where her story went and knowing that it's off book and there's nothing there else except for that script? What was that like for you?
Thing. And, you know, we're all sort of in the dark, all us actors. So I am anyway. I mean, I had lunch with Damon, like, I don't know, a year ago, November or something. And, you know, he'll never spill secrets, but I knew that I wasn't going to be in the GR anymore. And I knew that I was going to be Tom, obviously, because that's what you see. And I loved the idea that, you know, first of all, I love Chris Silka, but I loved, you know, Damon once described her and family as sort of split down the middle, and Tom and I are the seekers, you know, we're kind of spiritual seekers, and we both essentially went after false prophets, you know, but that doesn't mean that, you know, our impulse to, you know, find answers and go deep and help other people and all of that is still inside of us, whereas arguably, Kevin and Jill just want to have a good day, you know. Kind of just, so delicious because, you know, what The Departure did is arguably make everybody more so of what they already were, you know. Already, you know, there was already rift between me and my husband, you know, and then The Departure, what the hell, like, there's no reason keep it together anymore. I heard from Rudy, the wardrobe guy, you know, because again, everybody sees things before the actors, and he's like, whoa, Lori, you know, runs over the GR. I was like, what? What are you talking about? I thought I was trying to help. But you know, there again, I kind of love the development of that, where I said to David, like, do I actually, you know, run? He's like, just read the script. And the idea that, you know, and again, I'm not trying to make Lori the good guy because she's incredibly complex and weird. But I think she's not wrong. It's like a game of chicken and she's revving the engine, you know, and she wants people to wake up. She's a Zen master, right? Like, wake up, realize that it's easier for cannon fodder and they don't get out of the way.
Can you talk about why you think Lori chose to leave the Guilty Remnant?
I think she doesn't trust him anymore. I think she's like full of, you know, if what we're trying to do is wake people up and, you know, I mean, I always connect Lori to who she was before, which is a therapist, you know, which is not to say she's always benevolent, but she wants people to wake up and to acknowledge reality. And, you know, that at one point, like standing outside and stalking people was seemed to me the best way to go. But that realizing, you know, that it's more, you know, they're kamikazes. I mean, they'll burn the house down, they'll burn themselves up. And also seeing my daughter, I mean, if you think about the structure of that scene, I was pulled out and my daughter was burning alive, you know, so I don't know who wouldn't run from that.
So you talked about Jill a little bit, and one of the things that I struggle with, I think, with the show, and it's a struggle in a good way, by the way, is Lori had this relationship with Jill, and it's obvious that Lori wants to have amends with her daughter. She's writing the note, and she wants to be there, even though she pretends like she's not. I've always struggled with that notion of why can't we just have that relationship? Is that something that do you think Jill is doing, or is that something that is Lori related? And more on the whole, what do you think is the biggest struggle that Lori has as it relates to her family now that she's out of the Guilty Remnant?
Jill, for sure. I mean, I think that Kevin and I, and you'll see this I don't know, there was some like Shonda Rhimes style Twitter fan who was like, I just want to see Lori and Kevin together because they're all such romantic. I was like, Lori served him divorce papers. Like, Lori's good. Like, Lori is happy for him and Nora. Like, that's, you know. And obviously, I'm connected to Tom. So it's all about Jill. You know, I think, what I don't know if we'll ever see, even knows if there's a season 3, but I'm always interested in, because the structure of the backstory is the departure happened. And then for about two and a half years, I hung in with my family because at the top of the first season, I've only been in the GR for like 6 months. So I've always said to Damon, like, I want to see those 2.5 years, you know, because to go from such a fully functioning person to joining the cult. You know, and this is sort of the soft answer, but in times of darkness, I think, well, maybe it's right. I said to Damon once that maybe I'd join the GR because I was going to hurt myself. You know what I mean? I mean, there are those moments where it's like, I'm not good to my kids. I'm going to hurt myself. I'm in a clinical depression, and Lori would know. And she thinks it's the better choice to remove herself. I mean, that's a little bit of a soft answer, you know? But certainly a lot of the season 2 is trying to repair with Jill.
You talked a little bit about Lori's relationship with Tom and about it being so special. I wanted to know, why is she okay with putting him in the kind of danger that he faced later on in Off Ramp?
Well, we're Bonnie and Clyde, you know? I mean, I'm not his, he's a grown man. And I think that, you know, I don't know who first came up with that. I mean, I probably, you know, was finding the stray lost GR members, you know, and then doing my thing. And probably he said, you know, let me go in. I can go in. And then from there, it's a dance. I mean, I think that he's drawn to a certain intensity. I mean, there, you know, I was just looking at the scene today where he's with Meg, and I just say, no, that's it. And I do have a lot of confidence about my book at that particular moment in the story. So I don't think I'm like willy-nilly pushing him in there. You know, I think it's something that, you know, we came up with together, and it's sort of working because he's so adorable and trustworthy. But I also smell her as a mom, like, okay, this has gone too far. It's not good for you. But you know, that's what's interesting about the relationship. I mean, the guy's not 15, you know, it's my adult child.
Did Tom tell Lori what happened with Meg? That was a little unclear to us in the episode.
Or at least give us your opinion on what you think happened.
No, I don't think I know the extent that happened. I mean, I think I just hear her. All she says is, who's Meg? And that's enough for me because I know she's messing with them. But I don't think he told.
Can you tell us if the meditating Buddha on your laptop, speaking of your book, was your suggestion? Because it's shown quite a bit in episode 3.
It wasn't actually, but I liked it. I don't know where that came from. I mean, I think it was, frankly, just as a prop, because all computers look alike, you know, to make sure that we knew which one was Lori's. But I quite liked it.
That's a good idea, or else you would have just stolen the kid's real laptop that was his,
you know,
to begin with.
I mean, everybody has Apples, like, they're all the same. So.
can I just say, I loved that entire scene and how it was shot and the way you reacted. You went in there and you just took the kid's computer. There was no, I expected a little bit more finesse, you know, like, oh, hey, little Billy, can I have the computer?
No. There are no children in leftover home.
So there's this great bit when Lori hesitates for a moment to go into the meeting with the book executive when she learns of her patient's death. What do you think was the internal conflict in that moment when what Lori was facing?
Well, I think I think she absolutely was about to say to the guy, I just heard some terrible news, I can't go in, you know? I mean, there's no doubt in my mind, she knew she was in no shape to go in and have that meeting. And I just think that's so believable, you know? We've all had that moment, you know, getting some shocking bit of whatever and then having to go and teach a class or be a parent or, you know, you just have to sublimate it. So, I think it was pretty clear to her, like, I can't actually sit in this room and have a coherent conversation. But then that brilliant actor and the way it's staged, he hustles me in and before you know it, I'm sitting there. But, I think it's shock. I mean, yes, if she had a couple more minutes to think about it, it's like, holy shit, like it's not working. I mean, this, you know, your whole thing is called into question, but, you know, I do say, I don't want to go in. I mean, I say to the receptionist, like, I just got this call. And then before you know it, I'm in there.
So we also, you know, we go through the whole conversation when you're in that room and the publisher, we've already mentioned this. I already made fun of it a little bit earlier, but the guy goes through the whole story and everything that was happening. And obviously, Lori attacks the book publisher. Do you think she was angry at him for all the things that he was saying, bringing it all up? Or do you think Lori was a little angry at herself for all that he mentioned?
I mean, all of it. He's such a smug presence. You know, it's anybody. I mean, again, I think it's an amplification of the grief experience when you're out there in the world and having an inane conversation. And, you know, sometimes you can do it. A lot of times you do it. You know, you kind of hang in. But I think there are those moments, and this is sort of the millionth degree of that moment, where I can't bear it. You know, I mean, her heart is breaking. And he's saying, what do you feel? What do you feel? I'm not getting feelings. It's like, oh my God, I'll show you what I'm feeling, you know? So I love that scene. I mean, because the guy, it's just such a great scene. And I think it's a great scene for artists, you know, because in the New Yorker article, they said that scene was sort of like Damon explaining loss to his fan. You know, what does it mean? What does it mean? What does it mean? What does it mean? And, you know, I feel like I sort of embodied Damon Lindelof at that moment. But, no, I think it's also when there are no words, right? When there are no words. So I don't even know if I would, like, categorize it solely as anger. I think it's an explosion, you know, it's an explosion from the psyche up top.
You know, I feel like the publisher also served as a surrogate for a lot of the people who aren't necessarily on board with the leftovers of, okay, well, what's the GR about? Why do they smoke? Why this? Why that? I always felt like that was Damon's or I forget who else was. Oh, Patrick Somerville, who wrote it. I think that was just their way of saying, listen, it doesn't matter why they smoke. They just do. And the world ended. So just accept it as it is. Do you think that would be a reasonable assumption?
Yeah, I do. I mean, you know, one of the reasons there's a million reasons I love this script, but, you know, as I said to Damon, you know, it's very rare. I mean, I can't think of another time I've had this experience where, you know, I go through the whole first season being really enigmatic and mysterious, even to me, you know, the character, and then to have an entire episode and explain yourself, right? Mm-hmm. To be able to say, this is why I did what I did. This is exactly what I did. I mean, she tells the whole story. It's like, you know, I had this patient and then she, you know, recruited me. And so to give words to something that you've been sitting on, you know, for an entire season of television. So I think that's another example of that. It's like, okay, let's talk about it. Like the GR, it's like, why? It's like, I don't know, you know? you know, I think it's funny. It's like, I was talking to Kevin Carroll last night. We did an event with Damon and Kevin is experiencing what I first experienced last year, which is like this amazing world of, you know, I'm not a huge sci-fi person. I'm not a kind of a fangirl, but there is this signs and portents and what does this mean? Everything is sort of endowed with this meaning, which is beautiful. And I will tell you, like, having read all 10 of this season, like, things come back in the way that, you know, just like a good book, you're going to want to go back and watch the other ones and other, you know, the previous episodes. But then there's other things. I mean, I think he plays, and Tom, you know, comes right from Tom's book, how do we live alongside mystery? Some people are grateful with it. Some people are angry about it. But there's mystery in our lives every day. So in that way, it's not terribly far-fetched.
Yeah, I think one of the beautiful things that The Leftovers does is it embraces, and obviously this is a trait of Damon Lindelof, but I think it embraces ambiguity. It finds the beauty of ambiguity, and it asks the viewer to engage it halfway. And enjoy itself and find meaning, ascribe meaning to itself for the viewer. And one of the things that I think is really ambiguous, and I wanted to get your opinion on it, is Tom and finding a place to belong for him and for Laurie as well. You mentioned earlier about how they were seeking out these false prophets and they were looking for a sense of belonging. Do you think Laurie has found that belonging now in Tom and potentially his magic hugs, if he does have that power or not?
Well, I think Laurie has found her place in her vocation, which is, I mean, she is obsessed with deprogramming GR, you know, so she would do that with or without Tom, you know. But, you know, like somebody who breaks up with a boyfriend and they hate them, and that's all they talk about. You realize that's all they talk about. She is obsessed with the GR this year as she was last year. But I think that she absolutely has found her passion with that vocation. And I think, and the fact that she has her son by her side, she's great. And frankly, the fact that Kevin is now happy with Nora, I think is great too. It's like, I don't have that guilt from the breakup guilt. Lori is the missing piece. Jill is the missing piece. I mean, that is an unresolved heartache that also gets explored.
Well, I can't wait to see it. And the final question I have for you is a little off book here, but if the departure really happened, how do you think Amy Brenneman, would react? Would you pick one of the cults to join, like the GR or the Barefoot People or the Hugging Everything? Or would you go to Miracle? Or would you put your head in the sand and whistling past the graveyard like it didn't exist?
That's such a good question. Well, I think the big question is, you know, if all the rules were off, which they actually are existentially. If you do good deeds, there may or may not be a heaven. You know, I mean, when you think about it, it's like, okay, but if I could, if really it was, you know, it's a little bit like, you know, if you have 6 months to live kind of thing. I don't know. I think, well, if a lot of my loved ones hadn't departed, then I might be relieved and sort of freed up in a weird way. I'm like, okay, let's play. Let's go to the beach. Let's not worry about, putting money in the bank kind of thing. The GR I wouldn't join. The Barefoot People look like they're having fun, but they're a little dirty. Maybe the Barefoot People if they had hot showers. That's what I would say.
I lied. I have one last question for you. And then I can let you go on your very busy day. You talked about, I don't want people to all of a sudden like Laurie. I'm not trying to, you know, stump for her or anything. But I am interested and I'm curious about what you feel about that character and what you want the audience to feel about that character.
Well, the joy of this year is that I get to explain myself. I mean, that I processed so much of this last year and I thought, oh my God, am I really like that really boring actor that just needs to be loved all the time? Because I'm really not used to playing villains, right? I mean, I'm used to playing complicated people, but, you know, there was a moment last year where I realized, like, oh, I'm the villain of the piece, you know? And I that's so interesting and uncomfortable. I think what I really wanted to do was explain Laurie. I mean, I'm not in charge of whether people like her or not, but I do feel on much more kind of comfortable footing, you know, even though I'm running over people with, it's very clear why she's doing what she's doing. I mean, she just hates this cult and she thinks they're full of crap and they are bringing people down the garden path just like they did with my family. So in that way, I feel like, okay, I'm explaining myself and then, people like me, they don't like me. Whatever. Mm-hmm. I think women are super complicated. I mean, certainly for me last year, like the biggest hurdle, I could kind of go with everything, you know, with the leap of faith, but obviously the abandoning of the children is, you know, as a mother myself is always like, oh, But even that, like Damon has taught me about, you know, that people are complicated, and you know, it's more of a common literary trope for men to leave. I mean, I feel like every novel is about some dad leaving, you know, than reconciling. More unusual for women to do it. But that's why this is a cool role. It's challenging.
Well, Amy, I'll speak for my wife, who's actually taking care of my beautiful 5-month-old daughter right now upstairs.
Oh.
I'll speak for her, and I'll speak for all the listeners that we have, everybody that enjoys this podcast and your show and you, your role and the job that you do. Thank you so much for joining us today. It was an absolute honor to speak with you, and I really cannot wait to share this with our listeners.
Oh, thank you for taking the time and your interest. I know you've been an early and ardent fan, so thank you for that.
Yes, we were. I'm proud to proclaim this. We were the first podcast dedicated to The Leftovers, and I'm extremely proud of that fact.
Oh, yay. Congratulations to you.
Well, thank you so much again. I really appreciate it, and I hope to talk to you again soon sometime.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you once again to Amy for joining us on the show. Blake, what did you think?
I absolutely adore her, and the fact that she's a New England gal, which is even better because she's originally from Connecticut, as a matter of fact, she is just freaking awesome.
You know, it kind of worries me that she and Ann Dowd, who played Patty, are from New England. Like, it makes you wonder, like, oh no, if you live in New England, does it kind of mess you up? Like, is there something wrong with us because we get blizzards and hurricanes and we become hermits for, you know, 6 months out of a
and
year?
And guilty remnant people all of a sudden for no reason.
That's what I'm saying.
Don't know. Yeah.
That's what I'm saying. Oh, man. Well, once again, thank you so much. That was awesome. We also want to thank our blog members for chipping in. So if you guys haven't had a chance yet to check out the Living Reminders blog, it is like the coolest thing.
That's right. You know, when we found out that we were doing this interview, we wanted to make sure that we got all the questions right and get everything that we thought was relevant for you guys to get the most amount of information possible. So I just wanted to personally thank all of the writers, including the editor-in-chief, Missy Ortiz, and all the writers, John and Russell and Kendra, Ashley, Angelica, Franziska, Mike, Brian Davids, Chris Hartwell, all of you guys, you all contributed to they all contributed to the questions for this interview, and I'm so happy that they did. Thank you. It's an honor to work with you guys. So please go ahead and check out the Living Reminders blog and see all of their awesome articles when you get a chance. That'd be great. Thank you so much. My love, are you ready to close out the show?
You bet. We want to keep this conversation going and would love to actually know what you thought about this interview. Reach out to us, please, on Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram. Our handles are Living Reminders. So that's LivingReminders. Just one word.
Wow, you should be like part of a spelling bee. If the social media isn't enough for you, you can always reach us at livingreminders@gmail.com.
Or you can visit our website, thelivingreminders.com, where you can see all previous episodes, all of our previous interviews, too. So check that out.
Interviews including Ann Dowd and Carrie Coon, Christopher Eccleston, Mimi Leader, they're all there. And while you're there at thelivingreminders.com, there's a little button on the top right-hand corner that says support. And there's a bunch of ways that you can support us, The Living Reminders, to help keep it a free podcast. Number one of them is donating $1 or $2 to Patreon. We'd be glad to accept any donation that you'd be willing to give. But the most important thing you can do for a free podcast is to tell a friend. Tell a friend that on Facebook or Twitter that we exist, that the show exists, and that there's this amazing podcast about it that we can you can nerd out with an entire community of people. We would love for you to tell someone that we exist.
Believe it or not, there are people that do not know that The Leftovers exists or
Stop
that our
it.
Podcast exists.
No
it's true.
Way.
It's true. So, okay.
We're a media giant.
We're coming up to the month of November,
mm-hmm.
and it's like a thankful month. You know, it's the month you're supposed to be thankful. So we are thankful to you, and if you are thankful to The Leftovers show or to our podcast, anything like that, we want to bring awareness to it. So head on over to iTunes. Okay, right now, the Living Reminders podcast has 59 ratings and reviews.
Mm-hmm.
I charge you listeners to bring it up to 70 by the end of this month.
Oh, big number.
Okay, the reason being, the more ratings and reviews there are, the more likely more eyes are going to see it. iTunes, like, rates it, so more people see it, even if they don't watch the show The Leftovers. So this is one of the biggest ways we can let people learn about the show.
Sure, and the last but not least thing is to go to the Living Reminders blog, and you can find it at thelivingreminders.com. Hit the little button that says blog, and you'll be able to see all of the great articles and great ideas by all the writers we mentioned early on in the episode. So please check out the Living Reminders blog.
As for now, ladies and gentlemen, I'm Mary Larson.
My name's Blake.
We're the Living Reminders, and we're still here.